What's up, everybody? Welcome back into another episode of Cult Film Cafe. Of course, it is me, one of your hosts, Jonathan, and as always, I'm joined by my partner in crime, Kenzie.
Hello there.
Yeah, it's another episode where we're in the same room. This will be a regular cons. It's kind of weird seeing each other. But yeah, it's good. It means that we've got less editing fucking headache, which I'm going to enjoy because it should be a lot smoother. Anyway, enough of that technical bullshit. You don't want to hear about that. But on this episode, we will be talking about the 1984 epic space opera, Dune, directed by David Lynch.
A beginning is a very delicate time. Know then that it is the year 10,191. In this time, the most precious substance in the universe is the spice melange. The spice extends life. The spice exists on only one planet in the entire universe. The planet is Arrakis, also known as Dune.
You are about to enter a world where the unexpected.
Many dangers exist on Arrakis.
The unknown. An incredible secret has been kept on this planet. And the unbelievable meet.
I see two great houses.
Where kingdoms are built on earth that moves.
And we have worm sign, the likes of which even God has never seen.
And skies are filled with fire.
The prophecy which will cleanse the universe and bring us out of darkness.
Where a young warrior is called upon to free his people. A world that holds creation's greatest treasure.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
And greatest terrors. A world where the mighty.
This is genocide.
The deliberate and systematic destruction of all life on Arrakis.
The mad.
I will kill him!
Forever.
And the magical.
Father, the sleeper has awakened!
Will have their final battle.
Long live the fighters!
Do not show the slightest pity or mercy!
Emperor, we come for you!
A spectacular journey through the wonders of space and the mysteries of time. From the boundaries of the incredible to the borders of the impossible. Now, Frank Herbert's widely read, talked about, and cherished masterpiece comes to the screen. Dino De Laurentiis presents Dune, a world beyond your experience. Beyond your imagination.
So yeah, I am familiar with this film, this iteration of the adaptation. So I've already seen this version. I've also seen the new version. I've also read some of the book. Kenzie, this is a first watch for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think I had heard of the thing for a while, and it's just not. I had just heard it was bad, I think, and then of course the new one was coming out, and I was like, "Oh, the new Dune." Oh, well, that was a couple of years ago now, but So I had never checked out. I had heard it was bad, and then like I was speaking to my parents about it, like I don't know when it was, maybe a month back or so, and then my dad was like, "Oh, no, it's good. Oh, you're dissing a film. Oh, your generation." I'm like, I'm pretty sure it was like even at the time it was known for being bad, wasn't it?
Aye, I mean, David Lynch has kind of distanced himself from the project. So, yeah, I'm pretty sure there's even some versions of it where he uses a false name.
He uses Alan Smithy, I'm pretty sure, is he not?
I'm not sure, but, like, everybody knows that he's been attached to this project, so it's kind of, even though he tried to distance himself. We all know he was involved to a point. I don't think he ever got full control, which is probably the reason why it ended up the way it did. So yeah, it's a strange one. This is a kind of sad note for me, is because my most anticipated film of 2023 has now been delayed into 2024.
I was wondering about that, because I was like, is it coming out this year or not? It's getting kind of late. What was it meant to be? Was it December?
No. September? October? October, I think, because the podcast that I listened to, they were talking about that because a lot of films have been pushed, that October's nowhere near as big as it was going to be, because there was a lot of films set to come out, and that was one of them. But because of what's going on with the writer's strike and stuff in America, they've pushed it to, I think it's March 2024.
Well, that's quite a big push, actually.
I think the first film got pushed as well, though. That was true to COVID, though. So, yeah, it's a bit of shit. I'm kind of gutted. Like, I've not been to the cinema as much as I would like to be. But then again, there's not that many films that I'll look at and go, I really want to see that.
It's been a good year for me, actually.
You. And then also, a lot of the films that I want to see are going to be coming to streaming services, like The Killer, that's Netflix.
Well, that's still this year, right?
That's coming out, yeah.
Is there a trailer yet?
Yep.
Wait, there is? Oh, yep. I had to check that out. There's also Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yep, Apple. That'll be on Apple. I don't have Apple. I'll just bump Kenzie's Apple.
I've got Apple. I can get to you. Maybe I can come around here and we can watch party.
Watch party. Killers of the Flower Moon. It's like 3.5 hours long, though. So.
Is it?
Fucking yeah, hell. Long film. Also, there's another Hitman film coming out called Hitman. Is it Richard Linklater? I think so.
Is it anything to relation to the games, or is it just like separate?
No, see, this is another conversation where, like, how do you, like, how do you get a distinct difference? Yeah, it's the Hitman, and then you've got the Hitman films based on the Hitman games, and then you've got The Killer, which is about an assassin, a Hitman. So it seems like Hitmen are in vogue at the moment.
I love Hitman.
In the world of cinema.
It's good for me. I love Hitman.
It's Glenn Powell. He was in Top Gun Maverick. He was like the kind of the cocky one.
He was the arsehole. Yes.
So, Richard Linklater. This is another Netflix. It seems as though anything that's going on to streaming a la Netflix or Apple's not getting pushed, because obviously it's a streaming service. And it seems as though that's where the biggest debate and the strike's coming from, is because they're not getting paid what they should be, or what they would be getting paid if it was going on network television compared to streaming. I don't know how much you know about it.
Not too much. I've heard little things there and then, but I'm not entirely sure what's fully going on.
So, as far as I'm aware, you've got before streaming became a thing, any time an episode or anything that you'd written or been a part of got aired, you got a percentage or whatever the royalty is.
Is that always the case?
No, depending on your contract.
Yeah, because I was thinking. Because I saw a video of Aaron Paul talking about how he makes nothing off of Breaking Bad on Netflix. But I was like, but that would make sense if you didn't have any kind of contract to get that. But if you did, does it still not count for Netflix?
No. This is where I'm getting to. It does, but it's not the same. So I think I listened to somebody that was a writer on Friends. And Friends was like the most popular TV show in the world for a few years. So whenever that got aired, and TV shows like that go on rerun.
Yeah.
So I think this example works because Friends is currently on Netflix. Well, in the UK anyway. I don't know where you would watch it in America, but we'll use this as an example. So if the episode went on to like an American TV service, every time that would be played, you would get money. But what's happened is whoever owns Friends, the entity, has signed an amount of money for it to go onto Netflix. So they've only been given a one-off check. So it doesn't matter. So if Friends on repeat 100 times, they only get one payment. So it's whatever the percentage of the overall payment for it to go on the streaming service. So they're not getting it every single time it airs. It's a bit like, you know, Drake and Josh, the TV show. Because it was like, there's that comedian guy, Jason Nash, that works with David Dobrik. You know what I'm talking about? Like, David Dobrik married his mum, who was like 60 odd and that.
Aye.
You know, he's kind of got blonde ish hair.
Yeah, I know David
You know
Dobrik.
What I'm talking about? Know, but you know, Jason Nash is the older guy that David Dobrik's friends with, right, which was kind of what everybody thought it was weird. But he's a comedian. He was on an episode and had one line in that show. But he gets residuals, or every time the episode's shown, he gets a check, or it'll come in. But the kid actors, because they were kids, they don't get residuals. They just got paid per episode. So the people that were in it, I don't know if it was Drake and Josh it was in, maybe it was. I think it was. But the kid actors that were in it, they don't get anything. They got paid per episode, and that was basically their salary. That's all they got. They don't get the extra money every time the show goes on a rerun. I think actors might be the same, because you look at somebody like Friends, for instance, they were getting paid $1 million an episode in like the early 2000s. For the last season, all six of them. So say they've done 20 episodes, they've made 20 million, I don't think they get a royalty. But I think it's more the writers that is the issue.
Yeah, that's...
Because they have residuals, whereas the talent normally gets paid up front, and that's what you kind of sign away. You've heard about this in film contracts, where, like, famously for me, Leonardo DiCaprio waived away salary for Inception so that Christopher Nolan could make it, but took a 5% of the gross, overall gross, as his salary, and he ended up making double what he would have, because like, the film made over 800 million and he made like 40 million instead of 20, 25, which is his fee to be in a film. Which it can work out. Like, Tom Cruise has got ridiculous money in Mission Impossible films because he gets a back end and a big fee up front. So there's all that at play. But I think everybody should get paid for their work regardless. Like, I think the streaming services are good in a way, but there's also a negative side, and that's obviously what's coming to light. And I suppose actors as well that aren't big names, they probably get residuals. Like that guy I was saying, like Jason Nash, he gets a small residual because he probably wasn't paid all that much. And yeah, I think it will get worked out, or I mean, it has to, because otherwise we don't have an industry. So just kind of shit, because everything's kind of not coming out, and it's kind of a weird gray area, and we're getting closer and closer to award season. So we're getting closer and closer to the Oscars and things like that. So hopefully it gets sorted out and we get the films eventually, but it wouldn't surprise me if a lot of films keep getting pushed back. But we're safe with the Netflix and Apple ones. They're definitely coming out. And obviously everything that's came out is not touched. But yeah, sad times. I was looking forward to June Part 2. The first June part, not this one, the June Part 1 that came out in 2021 was a fucking phenomenal film. I wrote a review about it. It's on my website. If you would like to read it, it's not that long. You can find it in my bio on my Instagram. It's at the protagonist journal. Yeah, got some content up if you'd like to see it. Shameless self plug, but anyway, let's get back to this film. So yeah, this production is kind of well known for being a disaster, but this film is. The production of this book to film had been a disaster from the get-go. There's a lot of big names that had been attached to it to try and adapt it in the 70s. Ridley Scott was one. I think the most famous one was Alejandro Jodorowsky, who I'm sure there was a documentary made about it being unsuccessful. And then eventually the famed producer, Dino De Laurinaitis, bought the rights and eventually put the money in and hired David Lynch, and this is what we ended up with, for better or for worse.
I mean, yeah, I mean, they finally made the Dune film, but was it worth it in the end? I don't know. I mean, I think at the time it wasn't received very well, and even still to this day, I don't think it's received. I know there are some people who like it. And if you look at kind of reviews, it's kind of middling. It's middling to being slightly above average, but I think there's some people who like it. This was a first watch for me. I can just say right now that I was not much of a fan of this film. And there's quite a bit wrong with it. It's one thing I think, okay, I'll start with one good thing about the film. I think it looks quite good, especially for the time. I think a lot of the effects and stuff used and like look quite good. And I've still kind of, for the most part, most of them have held up pretty decently. But bar that, it's probably like my only thing I can kind of the only thing I can compliment on. Because I don't know, the rest of the film's like, I watched this whole film and then at the end of it I was like, do you know what, I'm not entirely sure I had any idea what was even going on. It was just bizarre. This film's got like this really weird pacing issue, and it's trying to do too much at once, I think, as well. I think that's why this new, the new films have decided to split it in two. Because you get the first part of the film, which is like kind of quite long and kind of slow, and then suddenly it's like, oh, all right, and it just starts going, it just doesn't stop, and it's, that stuff starts happening so fast until you're suddenly at the end of the film, and it's over, and it's just like, what? He's God, or what? What's going on? It's just a bit crazy. Do you know what? It's one other thing I've been quite weird about this film. It's rated PG. I don't know what it is in like in America, but in the UK, it is rated PG, which I'm not going to lie. I don't know who at the British... The BFFC, BBC,
BBFC.
I don't know what they were thinking, giving this up. I don't know how on earth this got a PG rating. This is not like a PG film, and I think it would be pushing a 12 as well. I think it's probably should be given a 15. Like, it's not like it's like very violent or anything, but there's like certain parts of the film where it's like, okay, that was like kind of violent. Someone just got like a thing pulled out and the blood's just squirted everywhere. There's a decapitated person at one point that's like kept on for a bit, and Sting at the end of the film. That was pretty gruesome for a PG film. I don't know how they got away with that rating, but they did anyway. I'm guessing at the time it was probably higher rated, but now it's quite low rated. Some films like that from the kind of older films get, some weirdly enough, get like rated down. Because overall it is not actually that violent or anything. It's just got these little bits of like being kind of quite kind of gruesome at parts, which surprised me that it got a PG.
Oh, there's definitely some kind of horrible or kind of weird underlying tones in the film, depending on how you sort of see it. It's a PG-13 in America. I agree. Like, it has got some weird stuff in it that I don't necessarily think that young kids would understand or maybe should be watching, that there is some kind of horrible stuff in it. Baron Harkonnen is just an awful human being.
Is he the big fat guy?
He's the big fat guy. Like the Harkonnens in general, the baddies, like the bad house, I suppose.
Horrible to look at.
Yeah. But he's like, there's some weird people who kind of have got opinions about the character. Not being a very, very, very nice person, which he obviously isn't. I mean, he wants to overthrow and kill the Atreides. I agree. Like the pace in this film is ridiculous. I mean, it's like just over, it's like, what is it, 2 hours and 10 minutes or something?
Yes, really about that. Felt really long.
And the book's massive. And like, if you just put it in context with the Dune like adaptations, like now, the first adaptation, like the first part of the adaptation is like 2 hours 40 minutes, I think, 2 hours and a half, somewhere like that. So it's longer. It's only, so you haven't watched the Denis Villeneuve one?
No.
Right, you need to watch it, but you've seen this one?
Yes.
Right, I'm just going to tell you, right, I'm not spoiling it, but she, when Paul and his mother meet the Fremen,
yeah,
that's pretty much where the first part stops. So see the showdown that they have in that? Like, there's more of a kind of showdown between them.
Right, okay.
They have that, but they don't go out into the desert or that yet. Like, so see the bit where he's kind of became the Mohadib, and he's like talking to their people and he's leading their people?
Yeah.
That doesn't happen in the first part. like we're getting we get that in the second part, which I'm really interested in, because you're going to get about the same length of film, so you're going to have a lot of room to breathe and a story to actually happen. And I think actually in the first part of the film that you get to Arrakis a lot quicker in the new one than you do in the old one.
Right, yeah, I mean, which is good as well. Do you think they'll handle the second part? Because it does get kind of crazy in the second part a little bit. Do you think they'll handle it pretty well?
I think so, aye.
Yeah? I need to see the first part. I really need to, now that I've seen this, I want to see it kind of done right, because this was not it for me at all, really. I kind of was sitting at it almost at the point near the end of it, just waiting for it to end. And once it ended, I was just kind of like, what? Like, there's certain, like, oh, do you know what? I've got to bring this up, actually. It's the, I said most of the effects in this film and stuff and that look, actually looks, that doesn't look, that's probably the best part of this film, is it actually looks pretty decent. There's a couple parts, like when he's claiming the Dune Worm, or whatever it's called, and we can tell that doesn't look very good. But there's the one thing that especially I thought looked awful was the armor shields. They look horrible, and luckily they're not used a lot in the film, so what's the point in having shields if you never use them? The part at the start with Patrick Stewart and Paul, it just, I'm glad they didn't use it too much, because that shield effect looks fucking terrible.
Yeah, it's obviously aged a lot. I mean, you're looking at a film that's 40 years old. The effect in the new films is a million times better.
I'm guessing
like a million times better. I just don't think that David Lynch was the right person to direct this film.
Weird
choice. I like David Lynch. Right? I'm a big fan. Like Twin Peaks, Hive. Love Twin Peaks. And like he's done a bunch of really, really good films. And if he gets full control of films that he makes are incredible, and he's an incredible filmmaker. But I don't know if science fiction is really, like, this kind of science fiction, I should say, is really his wheelhouse. And I think that's why the new adaptations work, because I think the person in control is a big fan and wants to do them justice, and is known for science fiction that he's already done. I mean, he'd done Arrival, which people absolutely love, and the Blade Runner 2049, which is like a big scale kind of epic film based on
a
film that already exists that people absolutely love. And
I mean, that one's
great.
That one's a bit mixed for how people think of it, but I really like it.
Well, I love it. I think they're both equally as good as each other. So I think it's in much safer hands. So I think that's another thing to factor in when you look at the new ones. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, like, I obviously wrote a review about this a few years ago after I'd seen, well, a month or so after I'd seen the part one. And yeah, there's a big issue, because there's a lot of, if you are familiar with the text, there's a lot of real world influence, and it's basically like real world colonizing based in a space kind of background. And so you look at space as this otherworldly kind of mineral that the futuristic future need for space travel and stuff like that. So it basically makes the world go round, and it's like a minority of, like, you look at the Fremen who are being oppressed, which if you look at 50s and 60s, like, Earth, there was a lot of that happening where precious metals were getting mined, diamonds were getting mined, they still are to this day. And there's a lot of, like, real-world sort of symbolism in it, which is quite interesting. The one thing that kind of bothers me, bring a film like this to the big screen, is the cast gets whitewashed entirely. There is no, like, cultural diversity in this film. And they're meant to be different races of people, but it's, and don't get me wrong, when I wrote my review about Dune Part 1, like the recent adaptation, that's still got an issue with that as well, whereas it doesn't feel as blatant, because obviously when you make a Hollywood film, you've got to cast actors, you know, I mean. But I mean, Javier Bardem's Stilgar in it, Duncan Idaho's Jason Momoa, You've got Zendaya playing Chani, the Fremen girl. Like, there is a bit more. Whereas in this, it's like Sean Young, who's a white female, playing the Fremen, whereas Zendaya looks a bit more like how you would maybe imagine them to look. And I think anything, like when you do an adaptation, if you're familiar with the text, everybody's got their own interpretation of how they would visualise something. Like, if you read a book and you would have a picture in your mind of how you would see it. And I don't think everybody's is going to be the same. I think that's what is challenging when you do an adaptation. There's always going to be people that go, oh, I don't agree with that person being that character or that actor being there. And like, you know, because they don't have that vision in their own sort of film that they've made of this book. But yeah, like, I think this happened in Hollywood and it still does, is the whitewashing. And it's getting better, you know, like black actors and people from other ethnic backgrounds and ethnic minorities are getting a bigger and bigger voice in cinema, but it's still not perfect.
Yeah, I mean, I hope it's getting there now, but I guess with time it'll eventually just, well, we can hope that eventually becomes like less of a problem in films. It's just a weird kind of situation. I think we're getting like a weird kind of situation now, like, because it was originally whitewashing was the issue. Now we're having like a lot of like characters that we know as being different races changed. But it depends with what they're doing it with, if it's fine or not. Like, a lot of people were a bit annoyed about the Little Mermaid being, I think she's black in the film, the live action film. I mean, who cares about the live action film with the Little Mermaid anyway? All the live action Disney films have been terrible. But yeah, I know people were kind of like, Is this not kind of the same thing of just suddenly changing the race of a character? But I don't know. I feel so many people feel so different on it now. It depends. It depends on the type of character you're changing. Like, say for instance, like Jim Gordon was black in the most recent Batman, but that something like that makes sense because comics can be, you can change so much about a character if you want.
Yeah, but, Samuel L. Nick Fury.
Yeah.
I mean, he's white in the comics.
Is he? I thought he was black.
Well, like, there is a white version of him.
It's like stuff like that. You've got.
But I think what happens with comics is like if something's visualized on screen, they try and write it into new comics.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Because worlds of comics change. You know, there's different people's interpretation of like comics aren't just a linear progression from one to one. Like if you look at the Frank Miller Batman comics from the '80s. It's a completely different kind of story arc and style compared to the Batman that started in the sort of 30s and 40s and 50s. Yeah. Like, these kind of story arcs and stuff change, and it's all about where you kind of pluck that from. I think Jeffrey Wright was great in the new Batman film.
I thought he might be my favourite Jim Gordon, bar like the Gotham TV show, but I really liked him.
Who plays Jim Gordon in that? The guy for the OC?
Benjamin McKenzie. I think he's great.
I don't know, like, it's like, because the Gotham TV show is then, again, a much younger version of the character, because Batman or Bruce Wayne's a child, essentially, at the start of the series. And, I mean, I don't think he gets very old in the end of the series, you know what I mean? Like,
it's like ages with me.
You see what I mean? So it's like, it's a completely different style. I don't know, I still like Gary Oldman. Like, I'm not going to lie.
He's the best. He looks like Jim Gordon. You know what I mean?
Like if you took a still from the comic, like an OG comic, yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. But I think I think he's a, this goes back down to just casting the right actor for the job rather than sometimes people just pick the best actor that they can. Bane's the biggest argument is like, why was Tom Hardy Bane? Well, because he was the best actor available to play the character that wanted to be in the film. Does he look like Bane from the comics? Fuck no. Does he? Fuck. But who do you cast? Like a 7-foot bodybuilder?
Yeah.
But who can't speak a word or doesn't have any acting chops and can't like be in that type of production? Because it's not like 90s Batman with Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, big Joel Schumacher.
Yeah.
And I love Arnie. Don't get me wrong. I fucking love Arnie. And I can't, because there's talk about Mr. Freeze coming back and the new Batman sort of is potentially one of the baddies in this trilogy. I've got a bit of a love hate. I like the new Batman. I like Matt Reeves, but I just wish they didn't hint the Joker at all.
I
wish they could have done a series of films. And I know that he's the biggest fucking villain that Batman's got, or the most recognisable one. But there's got to have been a way where you could have made a story without him. Maybe not. I don't know. I've never tried to adapt a comic or like Batman. And maybe you can't. Maybe it's an impossibility. But I just... It's a tough act to follow, Big Heath, you know, so... He's going to have to be good. And the thing is I like Barry Keoghan as an actor.
I liked the little deleted scene they done. I thought that was pretty cool. If they do something dynamic like that, I'd prefer that than just having like the Joker as a villain.
But I just think the thing is like in Banshees Inisherin, he was incredible, like fucking incredible. And I think like I would like to see him in more shit like that, like more kind of acting shit and like character stuff before like he does a role like this. I still feel he's relatively young, even though he's probably not that young, but in terms of my familiarity with him as an actor, I just don't think he's like, I think it takes a certain person of a certain age to pick up the mantle of like iconic characters. And like imagine Christian Bale never done like American Psycho and things before he was Batman. I think if he was cast as Batman, folk would have been like, oh, why is he Batman? Like, we're... So, like, you've already got a sense of who he is. And like Heath Ledger, you've kind of seen him in other films and him as an actor and before he is in a film like this, you know? I think with Barry Keoghan, I'd just like to have seen him in a couple more projects before he's like going to take on this huge iconic role. Because I hope it's good, but it's one of these things where it could go really wrong.
Yeah, we'll just wait and see when it comes out in like 2024, 2025 as well.
Well, actually, I was saying that, but Robert Pattinson as Batman was a big fucking thing for people. Like, oh, he can't be Batman. I never really had a problem with it. As soon as I seen him in a Batman suit, I was like, hey, he looks like Batman.
To me, ages. I hated the suit. I didn't like him. And then I was like, oh, I'm wrong.
Aye. Like, it's a good film. And he's good in it. So, I mean, like, you could be like, oh, I wish it was somebody else. This is going to happen with James Bond. This is a big one, I think, at the moment. Because they've not cast anybody yet. And I'm surprised that. I thought they would have maybe done it a bit quicker. But I don't think there's going to be a film out for another couple of years anyway. So why rush it? But, I mean, the longer they take, the longer it's going to be for another film to come out. Because they're only going to production. So, and I think there's going to get a lot of backlash. There's going to be fans of the franchise who go, that's a fucking stupid choice. And then they'll watch a film and go, actually, that's good. I think Daniel Craig had that. I think a lot of people probably didn't see him going from Pierce Brosnan to him. And then you watch Casino Royale and it's one of the best James Bond films that there's been. And you go, he's fucking good in it. Good in the role. I mean, happens all the time.
I mean, yeah, I remember the Daniel Craig one quite well because I remember my dad just always going about how he thought, oh, he's just not Bond, he's not Bond. And then he watched the films and it's like, oh, they're actually really good films. And it's like, yeah.
It's like, talk about back to June. It's like when I seen the cast for the most like the new adaptations, I was on board, like, because it's a bunch of people that I really, really like. And like Oscar Isaac's in it as Leto and Timothy Chalamet, who is an actor I'm not super familiar with, but he looks more like a boy than Kyle MacLachlan does. Like, I know Kyle MacLachlan's only 25 in June, like, and it's his first sort of like feature film.
He's a bit weird.
But he's not. He does. He's not. He doesn't come across as a boy, and he's meant to. Paul's meant to be a boy. He's not meant to be a man at this stage. You know, he's meant to grow into this version of himself. And I think that's why Timothy Chalamet works, because he still does look like a boy.
I think the guy in the 1984 one, I think he's wrongly cast. To be honest, I think he does look quite young. Kind of like, he does look, the son about him is quite, like, makes him seem kind of almost boy. I think it's the way he acts or speaks.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he was just a complete wrong choice for it. It just seemed out of place with, like, the whole film to me. I think Timothy Chalamet would be a much better choice. I think he'll fit into the universe much more than I think. What's he say his name was?
Kyle MacLachlan.
But
he's collaborated with David Lynch now in multiple projects. He was in Blue Velvet. He's in Twin Peaks. He's like a big collaborator with David Lynch. But yeah, it was his feature film debut. So maybe that's when you're in with a bunch of actors who have been acting for years, like, you've got people like Patrick Stewart and stuff in the film, and, you know, some of the kind of older kind of actors, they're all of a different era, I suppose. I think 80s is when things in style started to shift. Like, a lot of theatrical actors stopped being in film productions, and you had more of, like, a method style from a lot of people, you know, like, you had, like, De Niro and Pacino's and actors that took acting really serious, and there wasn't as many over-the-top people that had been on stage, you know, like 50s and 60s actors, you know, like, they normally come from theatre to film, and that's a different style, whereas now people are actors for film and TV or either or and to be honest with you, there's a lot of people that work on films that probably wouldn't work on TV, and there's a lot of people that work on TV shows that wouldn't really work on film. It's that they are different art forms, but yeah, you can tell that, yeah, like, the 80s was a big sort of change, and yeah, the cast is a bit weird. I wasn't super familiar with a lot of people in this adaptation. Like, I know who Kyle MacLachlan is, obviously I'm watching it after many years after it's been released, so he's become a bigger name now than he was then. But obviously Sting, I know who Sting is, I know who the band The Police is, you know.
He was so ageist. Every time I saw him, they put him with the right family, but I still feel like he felt somewhat out of place.
Oh, he is out of place, aye. But it's strange.
He's so weird in the film. Like, I don't... Oh, that whole family's weird, but, like, he comes to that shower thing, and he's just, like, standing there, and the guy's like, is that his dad or is that his uncle or something?
His uncle, I think.
He's just sat and staring at him like, oh my... I'm like, what is going on?
Aye, like, this is the weird undertone about Baron Harkonnen. He's meant to be a homosexual.
Yeah,
and like young men, or prey on young men. Because see the guy that he unplugs, he's really the guy.
He seems like he liked him, and he just goes and unplugs him. Why? And
it's a black kind of oily blood stuff. That is the weird. That's a weird film.
Flies about the place.
He needs that to, because he's so fat. Like, in the book, he's meant to be much bigger. So he needs that so that he can move, because his weight's that heavy. So that's why he's got a floating suit. Right. So it takes the pressure off. So, because he does walk, it doesn't fly all the time, but it does, it kind of buoyancies him out a bit. Because I was trying to work out why the fuck he's wearing a big suit, but I googled it earlier and found out why.
There's a couple of things. I missed. Why do their eyes go blue?
Because of the overexposure to spice.
So it is the spice, right, okay.
Spice melange.
And it causes the saturation or something in your eyes, so you come blue.
That's why the Fremen have got blue eyes.
Right.
But Max von Sydow's character, so Paul Atreides asked why his eyes are blue. Remember when they first meet him?
Yes.
So he's the guy that he's been on there, he's like the ecologist or whatever, like the scientist guy that's been working for the Emperor, but because he's been on Arrakis for so long, his eyes have turned blue because he's been exposed to it for a length of time. But yeah, but that's why all the Fremen have blue eyes.
But in
this, they're like photoshopped or like CG'd or whatever. Like,
it looks a bit weird.
They've put an effect on all their eyes. In the new one, that's not the case. I don't know if they've managed to just cast people with blue eyes, or they probably just got blue contacts in.
Contacts, yeah.
Which probably weren't available in 1984.
Or, believe it or not, it probably just a visual effect. Wouldn't it be surprising. Cause like,
which is much better.
Yeah, because it's sound. I feel like you don't notice it. I think a lot of like eye effects now are usually just done visually.
But I don't know. I mean, because blue contacts exist, why would you not just put them in?
the same. I mean, it's probably just that. It depends. If you can see through it quite well, if it's got like a hole for the pupil, then it should be fine.
Yeah. Anyway, because it's not, see, in this film, it's something that distinctly stands out.
Yes.
You'll notice it. Whereas when I was watching the new one, you don't notice it. You know, like, because I've read the first part of the book, you know that that's a distinct characteristic, but it's not overly exaggerated. And, like, I think this is what's happened in the new adaptation, is he's made it kind of seem more real, like, more grounded. You know, we were having this conversation about the Batman and how people couldn't be in it and certain things is because it's too grounded. Like, it's too grounded in the real world. Yeah. Well, even though that this is, like, a big fucking space thing, it does feel like it's like the new adaptation is much more grounded and feels like a much more cohesive, like, adaptation, and you understand it. And a big part of that is having the space to let the story actually unfold, instead of all of a sudden you're fast forwarding 5 years and 10 minutes. Because in this adaptation, Paul Atreides, mum, I can't remember. What's her name? What's the mother called? Because I know Leto's the dad.
I'm bad with names.
Lady Jessica. Right. But she basically has a premature
birth,
but it's, the way it's shot is weird. It's like minging kind of thing.
Yeah, it was minging.
But what's happened before that is like the Bene Gesserit woman, and it feels like she basically embodies, like, Aaliyah, the Bene Gesserit, because she's powerful as fuck as a child. Like, you see at the end, like, she's just totally fucking the folk, and she's a wee kid. Like, at the end of the film, like, so she's,
yeah,
like...
that was weird.
She's,
yeah,
like, mega powerful, like... But that hasn't happened yet in the new ones. So it's strange. There's some weird effects, but... You see that, this is what I was going to say, you see the whole kind of premature birth, and then 10 minutes later, she's now like a toddler.
Literally, like, 2 seconds later, almost.
So that's my biggest issue with it. A couple of other production problems is, obviously, it was a failed production for a number of years, but you know that there's like 6 or 7 cuts of this?
I'm not surprised, to be honest. It did seem like it's kind of all over the place and stuff, could have been like completely cut out and stuff like that. Because its pacing is ridiculous. How can it go from being so slow to being, like, so, like, fast?
Also, fun fact, do you know that he turned down the director in Return of the Jedi to do this?
David Lynch did?
Yeah.
Who directed Return of the Jedi?
I want to say it was Irvin Kreisner, but I think that may have been...
But that would have been weird.
That
if he
might have been
it.
By Empire Strikes Back. So Richard Marquand directed Return of the Jedi.
That would have been weird if he directed that. Yeah. The film's kind of. Do you know what? I like the suits they wear. The
still suits.
They're really interesting. I like how the whole thing they wear. It's like, I don't understand why they need to put the thing up their nose when they're in outside. And it says you got to breathe in through your mouth and out through your nose. But when you see everyone outside with the things up their nose, they're never doing that.
I mean, they're obviously building in, like, this is obviously in the novel, so there's, like, the kind of, this is how they work, and it's basically the suit recycles your body's sweat so that you can drink it again.
Yeah, but
so
what's,
it takes all the salt out.
But what's the nose thing about then?
I'm guessing it's like hard to actually, breathe in the desert. I don't know.
And maybe, I mean, I thought it's like, oh, you breathe through your nose to get, like, to stop, like, the sand getting in your mouth. But you've got to breathe in through your mouth and out through your nose. That's what he said specifically. And I got really confused. So I was like, so what is it doing? But they don't explain it. Hopefully they explain it in the other film or something, because I was just kind of confused by what it was about. I thought the suit itself was a really cool thing. Like, it processes bodily fluids, it takes sweat, water. That was really cool. I like that. But yeah, that's pretty much the only thing I liked about the film, to be honest.
Anyway, but back to, like, a couple of other things. Like, so the first rough cut of June was over 4 hours long.
Jesus.
Lynch's intended cut of the film this is as reflected in the seventh and final draft of the script, was almost 3 hours. And obviously, like, Universal and the money people, people that put the money in, they expected a 2 hour version. They've gone into the cinema. Yeah. And Dino and Raffaella, the Laurinaitises, they excised numerous scenes, film new scenes, that simplified or concentrated plot elements and added voiceover narrations, which I think are shit. See, the voiceover shit, I'm not into it.
It even starts with like a weird kind of like explanation of something, then goes into it. Yeah, it's weird. There's a lot of voiceover near the end just because it's trying to get through stuff so fast.
Aye, so there was a television version aired in 1988. It's two parts, totaling 186 minutes, which is just over 3 hours. And he was obviously, he started using the pseudonym Alan Smithy. But yeah, this is a film where he's totally distanced himself. He doesn't talk about it ever. Like, apparently there's been numerous things brought up about him doing like an actual director's cut. You know what, like Ridley Scott's done with Blade Runner, and you get all these different cuts, and then you eventually end up in one where there's maybe some added, some taken away, and that becomes a definitive one. I think they want him, because I think Universal owns the rights. That's who produced the Denis Villeneuve one, so they own the rights to the book, so they own the rights to this film now. So they want him to have, because I don't know how much is still available of the original shooting, they want him to go in and basically do a director's cut so he could add, take away, reshoot. And apparently, like, for years, he's just been totally not interested in talking about Dune. Like, he doesn't want to discuss it. But apparently, in 2022, when there was a remaster of Inland Empire, he apparently admitted that he was interested in potentially doing it. I would like him to. I would like to see his vision all the way through.
Do you think it'll make it better?
Maybe.
I don't know. Another hour would maybe, like, could help it. But I don't know. From what I saw, I don't know, like, tons of it was cut out, so it's not really fair to judge it.
I think the problem is like, that there's a lot of time passed, and I think that's, like, because of, like, this is, we talked about it in the Blade Runner episode, like, because there was so many cuts of Blade Runner happening, like, even throughout the, like, 2000s, it still remained relevant. And obviously Dune had kind of fell by the wayside. There's been TV series and stuff, and I think there was talk of them about doing a TV show again. Obviously you've got the Denis Villeneuve adaptation, so it's becoming back in the kind of popular culture. So I think this would be the right time if he did want to, because Dune is getting spoken about more than it did. Yeah, I think it would be right if he doesn't want to do it, he doesn't want to do it. I don't know how else to say it. I mean, like we spoke about, we both have got our opinions of the film. As you can tell, we both don't really like it. I mean, I think the new adaptation is a million times better. In terms of the sort of criteria to make a film cult in the podcast, I mean, rewatchable, I've not watched it that often, this film. I think I've watched it a couple of times, and it's been for pieces of work. Like I said, I've done a written review about the new one, and I kind of compared it to this one, so I bought it to watch it for work, and it's not a film that I felt the need to go back and watch.
I would rather not watch this film again. I mainly just found it boring, and I didn't really know what was going on. It wasn't explained very well, and I was just kind of more confused by the end of the film. I just was waiting for it to end, and then when it did, I was just kind of like, okay. I don't really think it was explained very well, the whole film. I don't know. I mean, the music was okay. Well, actually, there's one song that's really I really liked, but bar that, I didn't really care for the music.
Obviously the music, I suppose I should preface it. I mean, the soundtrack was Toto.
Yeah, that was weird.
The score was Toto, apart from the Prophecy theme, which is Brian Eno.
Is that the thing I'm talking about? I don't know if it's the Prophecy theme that I liked.
About the start.
Oh, it's about the start, not. There's a part, see when he starts raiding.
Pretty sure that's about the start.
See when he starts raiding the worm, there's like a song that plays.
Oh,
like,
guitars and that.
That was sick.
That's Toto.
Like, that was good.
That'll be like Steve Lukather from Total. Like, that's definitely a Total song.
That's the only part that stood out to me with the score, so that's a bit rough.
I mean, low budget Stroke box office flops, another thing that we kind of talk about. This flopped, but it fucking had a stupidly high budget for the time, $40 million. I think it made about 30.
Why did people think this was going to... Did they think that this was going to make a lot of money?
It was a book that was very successful as well.
How old is the book?
60s, I think. June came out in like the mid to late 60s.
I mean, it still actually made okay.
65.
It actually still made okay money. It's just since the film was so expensive and didn't like perform amazingly, it didn't really go well for it.
Yeah.
More than kind of $10 million under the actual budget of the film for the box office. So.
Yeah, like not well received by contemporary critics, Joe reveals. This is where it kind of goes a bit downhill. It's a 1 star from Roger Ebert. The big man himself gave it 1.
Yeah.
1 out of 4. Rotten Tomatoes, it's like a 44%. 65% audience score, though. Empire magazine gave it 3 out of 5. The Guardian, 3 out of 5. So it's really, really in the middle. And if you sort of counter that to the new one, so RogerEbert.com gave the new June 3.5 out of 4. And I'm pretty sure The Guardian gave the June 5 stars. Empire gave it 5 stars. I gave it 5 stars. I'm the only person that matters on this podcast. Well, Kenzie does, but this is the podcast where I rate it. I mean, on IMDb, it's like 6 point something. It's a very middling film, I suppose, is what you would call it. I don't think it's anything that it blows the socks off of people. And I think there's a lot of things in it that people probably really don't like. Like myself, I would, you'll probably find out what I give this film in about 10, 15 minutes. Quotability?
No.
You're just like, no, definitely not.
Not a lot of the film was memorable to me. What was it? Sting starts screaming at the end, oh, I'm going to kill him.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's a couple of, like, you don't, like, the slow blades penetrates the shield. Big Patrick Stewart, big Gurney Halleck.
Yeah.
He's like, what's in the box? And we've got a what's in the box in this film.
What's in the box?
But Payne's in that box. Payne's in every box, apparently.
Apparently so, yeah. If there's a box in the film, don't open it. Or put your hand in
it. Well, he put his hand in it because it's the Gomge bar. But he was, this is a weird thing, because they're only meant to have women, children, no men. But because Leto wanted a boy, I don't know how you could control having a boy. But
it's not,
she had
it's
a
not
boy.
Explained.
It's not explained. This is a weird thing. They have a boy, but he's basically the Messiah. It turns out that he's going to be the leader of all people, I think, is where it's heading. And
we'll pretty much make him God by the end of it. He makes it rain on the planet. What?
I must not fear. Fear is a mind killer.
That's a good line. But okay,
yeah, that's a good line. I mean, it's got a couple. Like, I mean, but like I said, it's one of these where it's not a film that's got like standout one-liners.
Yeah,
there'll be massive fans of this film that probably disagree with us.
Where are the fans for this film?
Well, there is. That's why it's on the list of cult films, because it's another one. He who controls the spice controls the universe. It's very true. Because they need that. That's the weirdest thing. They need it to survive. It's like, see that mad fucking Krang thing? You know Krang for the Turtles?
Krang?
You know who Krang is for the Turtles? The big fucking brain thing.
Ah, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is that Krang? I think his name is Krang.
Yeah, I think it might be something like that.
Like, there's one of them in June. You see the big fucking floating brain thing?
What even was that? And then it disappears like when he drinks the water or something? I don't understand.
What are they called? It's like the... Oh, because they need it to fold space. See, this is the time travel jumping in this doesn't get explained, because they basically fold the space. They fold space. That's a bit of a strange one. The spacing guild to fold space.
And
that allows them to have instantaneous interstellar travel. So they need the spice, the melange, spice melange to power that technology. That's why it's so valuable. It's the most valuable thing in that universe.
So it's not a drug.
Well, but they can take it. Kinda is a drug.
And if they take it, it makes you go all mental.
Right, it's kind of weird. It doesn't get explained.
Like most of this film, nothing gets explained.
But the book's the same. It doesn't explain it. It's like it's not like an in-depth explanation of this is what spice is, you know. Like, the book's really long. Don't get me wrong. Like, the first part of the book's like 20 hours on an audiobook.
Oh,
it's long. But it's more about the story. And like I said, there's more real kind of world influence. Like, you can imagine what the most valuable thing on Earth would be. Where do you mine that? You mine that in minority countries. And where do the big powerful people go? They go and overthrow. It's like why the British Empire was the British Empire for a number of years. It's why you had big things like that. And that's basically in this version of the film, or in this film, see the diagram, you've got all the houses, but there's only four. There's only four houses, and they're all part of the Landstrad. But you've got four big houses. You've obviously got the Harkonnens, the Atreides, the Shaddam, like his house, that the Emperor Shaddam IV. Like, they're all the powerful people, and they kind of got... There's obviously other people in the fucking universe, but they're the only ones that seem to matter, because they're the ones that are controlling the bigger planets. Yeah. But also, that's another thing that really annoys me, is like, you see... And this, you don't get to see what Caladan looks like. That's like the ocean planet.
You see a little bit of it.
You don't really see it. But see in the new one, like Paul and his father, Leto, they have like a discussion outside on the planet. And you see, like, it looks kind of cool. I'm pretty sure it was shot in Norway, like, for the film. But that's another thing that annoys me with this one. It was shot in a studio. There's no real world shooting. Whereas the new one's got actual, like, real world places in it. Like, so they shoot out in the Middle East for, like, the dunes. Like, you can tell it's real.
Right.
Some of it. Not obviously not all of it, like, but, and it's the same with, like, Caladan. They've obviously found somewhere to shoot. Because there's a bit in the new one where, like, a big fucking spaceship kind of comes out the water. That's kind of cool. It's like,
apparently the visuals look amazing.
Oh, mate, you need to watch it. Watch it at some point in the next couple of days. Mate, it's an hour, two and a half hours out of your day, and we'll talk about it, and I'll get your opinion on that compared to this, because obviously the way they've been talking about this film, it's not, people know that we don't really like it. So yeah, I mean, I think quotability, I think the film does have a few ones for me, like, yeah, I mean, is it as quotable as The Princess Bride or Fight Club or, like, I don't know, films that will be coming up later on the list? I mean, mm-hmm. American Psycho's got kind of parts in it. I think there's films that are more parodied in culture than this film.
Yes.
So that's where you would probably get a quotable film. What else do we have?
Let me legacy.
Well, explores controversial topics, subjects, and themes.
Oh, we've got that as well. Sorry, I missed that.
We're missing one. See, this is where we kind of get confused about it.
How we missed one? So we've done box office, quotability, rewatchability.
Oh, we've done the contemporary critics. Two critics. Go. Explores controversial topics, subjects, and themes. It depends. If you take yourself out of common day place and put yourself back into the mind of Frank Herbert in 1965, you could see the real world sort of allegory going on, and then how that, like, power, this is this kind of age old thing, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Yeah. There's always that fight, and if there's something that's valuable, normally people want it and they want to be in control. There's some weird undertones in this film that I will leave that up to you, the audience, to go and watch it and kind of have your own reading. I wouldn't necessarily call this a super controversial film. Personally, I don't think it doesn't talk about subject matter that basically I'll make you turn away or make you, like, feel a bit like, you know, I think when we talk about a controversial film, you know, like, see when we've done Man Bites Dog, fucking, that was a controversial film.
Oh, absolutely.
So, like, that's the biggest difference. I think films like that are definitely controversial and basically get a tick in the box here. Films like this where there is undertones and themes and undercurrents could, for certain people, have it. You know, the whitewashing could be controversial to some people. You know, if you want to fight for minorities in the film industry 100%, you wouldn't look at a film like this. But then also, if you looked at anything this old or older, you're probably going to not be happy at all. So if that's your argument going in, there's going to be loads of cinema that you don't like. So have you got anything else to add to the controversy, do you think? I mean, you don't find anything controversial because of your age. Yous have all been like clickbaited with hundreds of shit and seen hundreds of shit online, and your friends walking about school with videos. Have you seen this happen? Have you seen this decapitation video yet? You know what I mean?
I mean, I never had anyone like that, but there's a couple of people in my course right now have told me they've known people who would just go about showing people that. So that's kind of fucking...
Well, you came up with an age of YouTubers like Logan Paul who basically filmed a dead guy.
Yeah.
And Logan thought Paul. It was acceptable to post online.
I can't believe Logan Paul's actually more... I'm more of an arsehole than Jake Paul. That's shocking.
But you think he is?
He's scammed. So he does bad. He does genuine bad shit. Jake Paul's an arsehole. Logan Paul does genuinely bad shit. Like, he scammed a bunch of people. It was because of the crypto sort of thing, and he said he'd pay them back.
But he's not paid them back. I've heard this story.
So he's just like that. As for the controversy, I don't know. Like, I mean, it's hard for me to kind of say. Like, I don't know. Like, it's.
If somebody your age viewing a film like this, I mean, I think you're going to not find it controversial. I think, like I was saying, if you watched a film, it would need to be distinctly out there,
yeah,
to be controversial. You know,
it's like, I mean, there's got a couple kind of violent-y moments or kind of grossy kind of moments, but it's not anything to the point where it's like, oh, it's too far. Really, I mean, some bars are kind of, I can't believe this, that Sting got stabbed through like the mouth like that. That's, again, for a PG film, that is horrendous.
Aye, but what I'm saying, that's not necessarily controversial. That's just things that shouldn't be in a film of that rating. Yeah. But like I said, I think there'll be people that watch this film, and what I would say is, and what is it? It's the kind of undercurrent and the kind of tones of some of the characters that, if you want to do your own interpretation of how you view them, you know, like I said, I think Baron Harkonnen is a fucking piece of evilness. But he's meant to be. And I think the Emperor is also a backstabbing piece of shit. Because the only, like, do you remember the bit in the copter, like, where they were going to see the fucking harvesters of the spice?
Yeah.
And you know how they have this kind of, some of the people have got existential power and be able to talk with their minds, like Paul has, and Max von Sydow's character has. And it's a bit where they're basically, he's going to lose the spice, but he doesn't care about that. He cares about the people. And yeah. He says, get in, and then you hear him, he goes, he's actually, like, oh, I'm
surprised that
but cared, I like this person.
Yeah.
But this is the thing, that's what annoys me about it, is because obviously Shaddam, Emperor Shaddam, and the Harkonnens have basically distinctly came up with a plot to basically take down Atreides, the house, because they're actual, like, they seem like genuine folk.
Mm-hmm.
So what they've done is they've captured somebody's wife, put them in there, and they get into the secrets and that. But what they don't realise is that Paul Atreides is an absolute fucking nut job and is just super powerful.
Yeah.
But I think it was sad. See when Leto dies, man. See, like, the thing is I don't have any emotional connection to this film, but see the new adaptation, I really did, because it's got actors and that I really like, because, like, Oscar Isaac, and it's like, oh, you've just totally fucked him over, and you didn't have to, because he's actually, like, a stand-up person. He's a powerful guy, but he has morals. Do you know what I mean? Whereas the other people don't. They're just out to fucking fuck people over.
Why did they know that Leto was going to die?
Who?
The witch people in that.
The Bene Gesserit.
They keep on seem to go on about, oh, they're the truthsayers. That he's going to die.
They're the truthsayers. They're like, each of them have, like, she's part of the Bene Gesserit monks. I think they're monks in the book. And there's obviously a line of them. And Lady Jessica's one of them. And that's why she's involved. And that's obviously how Paul becomes Paul Atreides, like the Messiah or the Mohadib or the all-powerful, whatever you want to call him. He's basically like a Jesus Christ godlike figure.
Do they want him to become that? Because she didn't want him to be, or no, they don't.
So the prophecy is that's the reason why she was told never to have a boy, because they knew that there was a potential for a son of one of them to become that. So if they basically tell her never to have a boy, if they all never have boys, that would never exist. But because Leto and her, Leto wanted a boy and wanted an heir, they have a boy. So the prophecy is that was always the potential to happen, but it had to be a male. There was always going to be a male that could potentially be one of them. Mm-hmm. But because call it the prophecy, I'm just using that word, but basically the truthsayers had seen, so see like Shaddam IV's Bene Gesserit, she's like the head one. Mm. She can kind of see the future almost. And it's a bit like the big brain knows that Paul Atreides is the problem. Because they don't want King Leto dead, they want Paul dead.
Yeah.
Whereas Baron and Shaddam only see Leto as a problem. They don't see Paul as the actual problem.
Right.
And that's why they don't actually kill Paul. They just take him hostage. Because they could have just killed him, but they don't. So that's how his mum and that end up freeing. Because he uses his kind of inner voice to basically manipulate. And she does the same. So there's a bit of mind control. But he shouldn't, because they're all women. The Bene Gesserit are all women. And he shouldn't have that ability. But because his mother's one, he has. And that's why he's dangerous.
So they think he's dangerous. They don't think he's going to be good or anything. They're just too powerful.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
That's why he's basically treated as like a godlike figure. Potential to be. Well, just think about how he acts with the Fremen people and how quick they just go, well, he's in charge.
Yeah, true.
They just become subservient to him. So, yeah, that's the whole point. So there's that kind of... they know that potential's there. And that's why she goes and tells him to put his hand in the box and then has him kind of hostage with the Gom Jabbar. That if he takes it out, then he'll die because she'll like stab him with a poisoned blade. But it's basically meant to be a test that's only passable for Bene Gesserits. And he shouldn't have been able to pass that test, but he did.
Right.
I mean, it was painful. You could tell he was struggling. But he obviously had... His mother leaves the room, right?
Mm-hmm.
But she also speaks to him in like a telepathic way. That happens in the new one where Rebecca Ferguson plays Lady Jessica and she leaves the room, but she basically tries to communicate with him. But
that doesn't happen in this one.
But it does happen in the new one, but she's been doing that with him from a young age.
Right.
So she's been kind of teaching him when she shouldn't have been. So she's been kind of fucking them over. But she knows the potential that Paul actually has.
Right.
There's a big story arc, obviously. He's got a huge story arc. That's why it's a bit of shit being condensed into a 2 hour and 10 minute film.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's more complicated than that, but yeah. So that's how they kind of how it happens. And Princess Urulon, who's the young woman that you see at the start, that's Shaddam's daughter. She's obviously like powerful in a way where she's part of the Emperor side. So yeah. It's a strange film. And there's obviously some strange context, but I like it. It's my kind of film. I really like sci-fi, but I'm glad that they didn't just never revisit this, because when I listen to the book, like say read the book, I listen to books, I don't read them. When I listened to the book, I was like, there's a reason why this was so complicated to make. Like there is a reason why it's complicated. But I don't think it was ever unadaptable. I just think it went through a process of different hands and wasn't necessarily treated the right way. Whereas I think now, this adaptation are people going to be like, oh, it's better than the book? Probably not. If you're a big fan of the book, you're probably going to like the book more. But I think that gives the general world a chance to see a film like that, which is actually really quite clever and actually got a really good story. And yeah, you should definitely watch the Denis Villeneuve one. It's so much better than this. And that's why, so basically that was the whole legacy and impact, yeah, massive. We're still talking about it to this day. There's new adaptations of it. There's documentaries about failed productions of it. I mean, it basically, from acquiring the film rights till Dune was released in 1984, I mean, this film has been in some form of pre-production or production. I mean, Alejandro Jodorowsky is the most famous one to fail, because he had this mad, big, huge vision that was never ever going to get financed, but he tried to get it off the ground so many times that I think, I'm sure he's Argentinian filmmaker. But there's a kind of documentary about that. It came out, and it seems to have became a more sort of pop culture thing to talk about now, whereas Dune kind of died for 20 years after the TV shows. I mean, you probably didn't really know what it was until the new film was coming out, you know?
No, not really. I knew of it. That was kind of it.
And I think the film does have a legacy, and I think this film has had an impact. I think if this film didn't exist, would the new one be getting made? Who can say? So I'm kind of glad this film was made, and we've ended up in an adaptation which is so much, so much better. So yeah, I guess we just need to give our ratings out of 5 popcorn buckets and decide whether this film's cult or not, and if so, where we would place it in our top 100 list.
Do you want to go first?
Yes, I'll go first. I'm not a huge fan of this adaptation. I like the book. I like the new film. And I think they're more comparable than this. But like we've spoke about, this has went through so many complications, and there's so many things that you can tell that made this film bad. So it's a harsh film to rate, because I know that David Lynch is a good filmmaker, and I know he can make good films. It's really hard to judge him based on one film, and I think if he had full control from start to finish, this film would be better. But I think there's a lot of things that have dated in it. I don't particularly like the acting in it. I think it's a bit stiff. I couldn't buy into the characters the same way as I could in the new one. So yeah, I mean, it's night and day comparison. Like, I gave the new one a 5 out of 5. I very rarely give films 5 out of 5. But I would give this one maybe a 2. I mean, I think it's watchable, and I don't want to take away and say it's a 1-star film, because, I mean, it isn't Baby Geniuses and shit like that, you know?
Yeah.
It's not like some of the worst cinema ever, but, I mean, I think a 2 out of 5 is a fair rating for me.
After watching it last night, because like, once it finished, I literally just went in my head, 2. I went, 2, no, 2. I was like, it's not two, even, 2.5, it wasn't even, it was under all right for me, it's got good elements. I agree with the acting, by the way. Yeah, especially with the main Paul. I just didn't get behind him at all. There's like good little bits. Like some parts of the music's kind of cool. Like I said, a lot of the effect, what the film actually looks like, it actually looks kind of cool. Has quite a cool style, but bar like that, it's just it was going too quick and didn't explain enough and got kind of muddled up, and it started off kind of slow, and it's like okay, and then it just picks up and then goes way too fast, and they tried to do the whole book and that failed. It was maybe a much longer film, but at the same time, the thing about making a much longer film is who wants to sit through a 3-hour film or a 4-hour film at the original? Most people don't. It's not like it puts a lot of your audience away when the film's really long. Like hell, look at like films like The Irishman. It's like, I personally really like the film. I love it. It's one of my favourite Scorsese films now. But I know people who really like the film but have been putting it off just because it's just too long. It's just, that's, you've got to be careful with that. So it ended up getting shortened down, and then that hurt it. Maybe if they made it into 2 films, like this one's doing, like the new one's doing now, which is like absolutely the right thing to do. 2 2-hour films. There you go. A good way to do it. Maybe that would have worked, but I don't know if they would have got the budget for that at the time. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Dune Part 1's, I'm sure it's 2.5 hours long. So it's longer than this film. And like I said, it stops at that point. Like, I told you, the bit where they finally meet the Fremen. Because there is a part earlier on in the film, you know, Stilgar, the leader of the Fremen people.
Yeah.
He, in the new film, I don't know, I can't remember if it's in the old film. In the new film, he comes to see Leto. Because Leto wants the Fremen people to be on his side. Because he knows Leto can sense something's going wrong. See, in the new film, you're going to... I hope you like it as much as me, because there's so many elements of it, you'll be like, fuck, like, this makes loads of sense. Because King, like, Leto, he can sense something's going to happen. So he tries to get the Fremen people on side. So when he goes to Arrakis, so see Duncan Idaho, how he's played, he's Jason Momoa in the new film.
He was hardly in this film.
But he's in it more in the new one.
Right, okay.
But he's basically been going to Arrakis to do kind of research, essentially.
Right.
And then basically he brings Stilgar. Javier Bardem plays Stilgar in the new film. And basically him and they try, but he goes, no, fuck you. I don't trust you people because the Harkonnens and stuff. And basically they have that kind of bad interaction and then they go away. And then the next time you meet them really is when Paul and Lady Jessica are in the desert. And obviously they have the kind of showdown part and then boom, pretty much film ends. So it's cut off at a really good moment as well. So I don't know when you're going to watch it. I mean, hopefully soon.
Hopefully soon.
Because that means your mum and dad not watched it.
They watched the first part. They really liked it. And they're like, where's part two? Where's part two?
Yeah, it's the same. I think it's more, people are more willing to wait for parts nowadays than they would have been back in the day. Like, there was very few, like, part one, part two. It was more like sequels, all right, so let's do a sequel. That's fine, because it's a new film. Whereas this is technically the same film. It's just we've cut it at a point. But I think nowadays people will be like, right, I understand it. Whereas back then, I think folk would just want a 2-hour film. And it's hard to take a text this big and turn it into something that's 2 hours long. Like I said to you, like, the audiobook, part one of the audiobook's 20 hours long. Somebody reading it. I mean, that's a big part one. And then you've got part two and part three. There's three parts to doing the actual full novel. It's a big, big book. But no, my sister, like, doesn't really like sci-fi, doesn't really like long films, but I think I can talk her into coming to see Dune Part 2 with me. I'm pretty sure I asked her and she was like, maybe, because she watched it and she fucking loved this film. Because I think it's, although it's sci-fi, there's a story and there's characters that you can buy into, whereas this film doesn't have it. It's, like you say, it's slow and then too quick, the pacing's wrong, the characters aren't great, they aren't fleshed out enough, they don't have any personality. I mean, in the new film, like, Paul Atreides has dreams of Chani, the Fremen lass, and you get to see them, like, visuals of them, like him having dreams of the Fremen, because he's got the power. But you start to get that seed from the get-go of what he is. It doesn't, like, he obviously has the kind of Bene Gesserit one-on-one stuff, but yeah, like, I think this film's done so much better. Anyway, you the same too? 2 out of 5?
Yeah, that's how I thought. Like, I thought maybe I could go a little bit lower, and I'm like, it wasn't the worst thing to watch. It was pretty boring for me, and I was kind of like, I wasn't that enjoying it. I mean, it's already not my type of film anyway, so it's not for me to be less interested in it because of that. It's not really the film's fault. I think it's a 2. It's watchable, but kind of only just. I wouldn't recommend it. Just watch the new ones. Like Jonathan says, the new ones supposed to be great. So, unless you're like really curious, you can just skip this.
Well, I mean, I think is this film, like, this is the next question. Is this film cult? Yes, is the answer.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of people that like this version. There is. I mean, it has got a cult following, but I'll argue till I die that this is nowhere near as good as the new one. I don't care what anybody's got to say. That's my opinion, obviously. I mean, people listening might have a difference of opinion, and that's fine.
I don't even know if it's opinion. It's like fact, surely, right?
Could be fact, but I mean, facts are very set in stone thing. So, I mean, I think film is something that's open to interpretation. But no, as cult, would you put it on your top 100 list?
No, I don't think so. I actually don't think I would.
I think this is the problem. It's like 100. Where are you getting 100 films from? Like, I, because I like this kind of film, I possibly would have it in my top 100. I think it's just down to personal taste. So I think there's a, I mean, if we get to the end of this podcast and we both make a top 100 list, it would be interesting to see the films that you have on it that I don't, because our tastes are different. Like,
yeah,
you would have a lot, I think in your list you'd have a lot more kind of horror films on it, especially kind of lower budget kind of culty horror films, because that's a genre that you really like and I don't really like it. So
it's a genre I'm kind of new to, but I only started getting into it a couple of years ago, but I've got quite into horror. I think it's a real, for years that I didn't like horror, and then suddenly it's like, oh, I actually think it's really interesting.
But I think it's as a genre film that has a big fucking fan base, which makes it infinitely a culty fan base. So, like, that's why Shudder exists. There's like a streaming service for horror fucking people. So I would be interested to see how many horror films that hit your list that I would not even know existed. I mean, I only know the ones that are kind of big and kind of noisy. I don't know any of the kind of smaller ones. But yeah, I would put it on my list. I wouldn't be, it would be kind of towards the back end of it, probably around 80 maybe. It's a decent enough film. It's just, I know David Lynch is capable of doing much more, and that's what kind of irks me more as an aspiring filmmaker. I really like David Lynch. But anyway, that is it for this episode of the podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. And if you would like to support the podcast in any way, you can by just going and giving us a wee follow over on Instagram at Cult Film Cafe. We are at Cult Film Cafe wherever you may find us. We have a unique Google search, plug that. If you search Cult Film Cafe, you will find us. And yeah, just give us a wee follow wherever you listen to our podcast. That would be much appreciated. And we hope that you enjoy them. And we will be back with another episode next week. So yeah, it's a goodbye from me.
And it is a goodbye from me.
Podcast out.